Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. Let others focus only on the horse race. We're exploring an issue a show for 30 shows between now and the election. You can see our 30 Issues gallery at WNYC.org/issues. And remember, this is not just a radio series. We also have a collaboration with longform.org featuring great articles to read about each of our themes. And the fabulous WNYC Data News team is posting interactive visualizations to illuminate all the issues. Today, since we're going to talk about labor, you can see a graphic showing private sector strikes, work stoppages over decades, and this curve is really dramatic. We'll talk about it later. See all our 30 Issues material at WNYC.org/issues. So here we go with issue 5, unions versus right to work. The whole issue of unions and labor relations is an area on which Romney and Obama couldn't be more different. And this goes way beyond the Chicago teacher strike or public sector pensions in general to the role of unions in private sector America and the state of the middle class. Listen to President Obama.
Now, let me say a word about labor in particular. You know, I know this is not going to be an easy time. I know it's not easy when there's some folks who have their sights trained on you. After all that unions have done to build and protect the middle class, you've got people trying to claim that you're responsible for the problems middle class folks are facing. You've got some Republicans saying you're the ones exploiting working families. Imagine that. Now, the fact is, our economy is stronger when workers are getting paid good wages and good benefits. Our economy is stronger when we've got broad-based growth and broad-based prosperity. That's what unions have always been about, shared prosperity.
So President Obama, from a Labor Day speech last year in Detroit, and now listen to Governor Romney, from a speech he gave in February of this year to the Associated Builders and Contractors.
If I become president of the United States, I will curb the practice we have in this country of giving union bosses an unfair advantage in contracting. One of the first things I will do, actually on day one, is I will end the government's favoritism towards unions in contracting on federal projects and end project labor agreements, and I will fight to repeal Davis-Bacon. I didn't know that was going to get that kind of response, right? I'd have said that earlier. I also, of course, am going to make sure that workers in America have the right to a secret ballot, and I will fight for right to work laws.
So Mitt Romney, about a minute in speaking to contractors earlier this year, President Obama on a Labor Day speech from last year, and pretty different, right? So we will have two pretty different guests on this. Our first is a pro-union-leaning historian named Nelson Lichtenstein. He's professor of history at UC Santa Barbara and editor most recently of The Right and American Labor, Politics, Ideology, and Imagination. Professor Lichtenstein, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York. What was Mitt Romney referring there that got him those whoops that I guess he didn't expect? Davis-Bacon, what is that?
Yes, that's very good. Davis-Bacon is the law which says that prevailing wages have to be paid on government-financed construction projects, which is really construction projects of, you know, post offices and dams, et cetera. And it means, and really the prevailing wage has been defined pretty much as the union wage. So these contractors who've been fighting the unions for a long, long time, they want to be able to pay, you know, McDonald's wages basically or something like that, much lower. And this has been a huge issue for many. many years, President George W. Bush, in the immediate aftermath of Katrina, said, "Well, I'm suspending Bacon Davis as an emergency," that created a huge controversy, and he had to rescind that. Hmm. So this is so it just shows that Romney actually doesn't really know very much about this the law here, because he was surprised he got a big cheer. Naturally, he got a big cheer from these conservative anti-union contractors that he was speaking to.
So, listeners, I see our lines are already filling up on this, so I'll give out the phone number so everybody has an equal shot. What should government's role be? And remember, this is about government's role in facilitating or hampering unionization or the strength of unions vis-a-vis management. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org/issues, our 30-issue section. So most of the heat, Professor, these days is over the public sector unions, exemplified by the Chicago teacher strike, just settled, obviously, and teachers have their unique issues with the evaluations. But I want to focus first on private sector labor relations, which fly somehow below the media's radar. But there's a lot of important policy here. So when Romney talks about private sector labor, the most common phrase he's likely to use, as in that clip, is right to work. What does that actually mean, legally or rhetorically?
Right. Well, in 1947, when the Taft-Hartley Law was passed, one provision of it was it gave states the ability, the right to pass laws which said that they could make illegal those parts of a union contract, even if they were agreed to by employers and unions. They could make illegal those parts of the union contract which said that as a condition of employment in this factory or that office, you must be a member of a union, pay dues to the union. And the idea behind that was that you're going to get the benefits of unionization, higher wages and this and that, representation on grievances. Therefore, you should pay your taxes to the union for that service. And then, so they made that illegal. And many states in the South and the Mountain West passed these right-to-work laws. What that had the effect of doing was to deprive unions of the funds needed to organize new workers, to sustain the workers. Really, it legitimized free riding. That is, a worker can say, I'm not going to pay dues, I'm not going to be a member of the union, but I want the benefits of the union. Well, that doesn't really work. So unionism in general is much weaker in the South and the Mountain West, although unionism is weaker in the private sector everywhere in the country. And can I make one little
sure.
minor historical point? What's happened in the decline of private sector unionism, the decline of the strike in the private sector, the decline of, we don't think of like the building trades. We think of the building trades unions as sort of conservative and they've been out here forever. They've had more of a reduction in size and power than many, many other unions. What that means is there are no more moderate Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller, or George Romney, Mitt's father, who, kind of got along with these conservative unions in the building trades, the Teamsters, the laborers. These were guys who just, they weren't political, but they just wanted their, more wages yeah. every other year. So these liberal Republicans, these moderate Republicans have vanished. They don't exist anymore, even maybe a few in New York State, but not very other places. And that means that the Mitt Romney embodies the new, more conservative, much more conservative, really southernized Republican Party.
And when you talk about the decline of strikes, the data graphic that we have on our website, and our data visualization team deserves a Peabody or something for coming up with so many graphics during this 30-issue series that illuminate so much. So we have this incredible thing up there, which is work stoppages per year in the United States. And it starts in 1947, where there are about 275. It peaks in the early 1950s, where there are nearly 500, and then it goes gradually down to last year, 2011, where there are almost zero work stoppages in the United States. And that's the history pretty much of private sector labor, right?
Right. Well, yeah, which is why when you do have a strike, and it's so unusual that people, like with Chicago, that it's like, where did this come from? Mars? These things used to be quite routine. They weren't taken with enormous alarm. They they went for a week or two, and then they were over. But now they seem to be on the right. They're denounced as racketeering, coercion, insurrection, et cetera, et cetera, because they're so unusual, and we just really had the disappearance of the strike period in American life.
Let me tick down with you and get some brief descriptions from you for our listeners of some of the things on the Romney website and then the Obama website, and get your quick takes just so people can know what's there. And then we'll take some phone calls. And as a little preview, probably half the calls on our board are people angry at Obama saying he's not really pro-union. He just talks a little bit pro-union. But on, here we go. I should say that that Romney has a long section on this, on the issues section of his website, many more words and many more specific proposals than on our topic the last 2 days, which was education. So he's really into this. And let's go through some of these. Romney says, amend the National Labor Relations Act to explicitly protect the right of business owners to allocate their capital as they see fit. That's a very general statement.
Yes.
Do you know briefly what
it
means?
Exactly what that means. Yes. Yeah, it is illegal under the NLRB, this is, goes way back to the 30s, and under many rulings, for a company to say, if you threaten a strike here in this factory, and it's really the Boeing situation. If you threaten to strike in Seattle, Washington, we will retaliate by moving our factory to South Carolina, and that was a big issue last year. Now, in fact, the NLRB has ruled for many years that the process of collective bargaining that managers cannot simply say, if you strike, if you exercise this right, which is given you by this law, we will move. We will close up and move. That has been ruled an illegitimate tactic, and that was what the whole cause of the, mm-hmm. of the controversy. So he's saying we're going to make that legitimate. Absolutely.
Okay. And Romney also says, amend the National Labor Relations Act to explicitly reverse the executive orders by President Obama that tilt the playing field toward organized labor. What executive orders has President Obama issued?
Contracting in terms of that I'm not precisely sure what he's referring to, but Obama has said we want to have prevailing wage. We look with favor upon government contractors who have collective bargaining and things of that sort. I don't really know exactly specifically what he means.
We'll get into that with our next guest too. Obama's website says Romney wants to shut down the National Labor Relations Board altogether. Do you know if that's true?
Yes. The Republicans, I assume Romney, if he agrees with the congressional Republicans, they have said basically unless the NLRB rules in the favor of companies like Walmart, which I understand is a sponsor of your show. Anyway.
No, what?
Well, I saw it. I heard part of the introduction. Walmart was one of the was an advertisement just before your show, I guess. Anyway.
I don't know if they're buying underwriting credits or not. I don't know.
The congressional Republicans have threatened, and in fact would do it if they controlled the Senate, they would deprive the NLRB of all its operating funds unless it changes its position on a variety of topics. Yes. So basically, the conservatives want to eliminate the National Labor Relations Board. Which in theory is designed to facilitate unionization.
Right. Just to be clear on what that underwriting credit is, since you brought it up, I gather that it's for forever stamps and various of the underwriting credits mentioned different retailers that they're available at. The spot we just played said Walmart. Another one says Staples, et cetera, et cetera. Just so people know what
you're
talking about. No problem. what does the NLRB actually do?
Well, the National Labor Relations Board was established in 1935 to facilitate unionization. It is in fact the policy of the United States of America to encourage unionization. At least that's on paper. And so it will hold certification elections. It will administer them, and it will determine who, if anyone, has violated the rules, so that a fair election can be held. Now, that's the theory. In fact, for a variety of reasons, the rules have been tilted, I think, dramatically in favor of management. So, just one example: free speech. The concept of free speech for management. Well, of course, managers have the right to free speech, workers free speech. Okay, fine. But in the workplace, what this means is managers, you know, can have one-on-one meetings. They can tell the workforce we'll basically close down the plant unless you vote union. They have captive audience meetings. When it comes to unions, no, unions can't go onto the workforce. And when they do try to visit workers at home, some rules have been held that now, this is intimidation. So it's tilted in management's favor.
But did you say that it's the policy of the government of the United States or the law of the government of the United States to encourage and facilitate and help the union movement?
Yes, it is. Yes, the preamble of the Wagner Act makes it very clear that the policy of the government is to encourage collective bargaining as a way of resolving conflicts, making sure that interstate commerce runs smoothly, and that there are no strikes and shutdowns, etc. Yes, that is the official policy of the law.
Why would it be the government's place to encourage unionization rather than to be neutral on that?
Because in the 30s, if you listen to Franklin Roosevelt's great speeches, he makes the point that if you want a true democracy in the United States, we have to have some equality of power and bargaining power between those who own property and those who do not. And that's very explicit, and the Wagner Act was written in that spirit, that democracy and commerce and raising, as Obama just said in that speech clip, raising the wages of workers is a way to prosperity. So the two things, democracy on the one side, prosperity and commerce on the other, the Wagner Act, the NLRB facilitates both.
One more from the Romney website. Amend the National Labor Relations Act to guarantee a secret ballot in every union certification election. I know this is a big, big issue.
Yeah, right.
Why do unions try to force those votes not to be secret? Isn't a secret ballot in our democracy supposed to be for the protection of the individual from pressure or reprisals after they vote?
Well, because the certification election over the years has really been turned into a management tool. These are really management-dominated elections. It's as if we had a national election in which one side could speak and the other side was blanked out on the airwaves. What the union movement wanted was card check, which was a faster way of having indicating what the sentiment of workers were, and one which avoided much of the routine and institutional intimidation that goes on in every workplace all the time when a union vote comes up. So the election was management uses that as a long drawn out affair in which they can bring in their experts, fly in their anti-union propagandists, and really browbeat the workforce. And so the card check was designed to speed it up, get around that, and have workers frankly sign cards as they chose and without management looking over their shoulder.
Before you go, I'm going to anticipate the calls that we're going to take in the next section, because as I mentioned, a lot of them are people saying, hey, Obama is not really so pro-union. He didn't show up in Wisconsin during the Scott Walker battle. He has pushed these new restrictions on the teachers' unions as much as the Republicans have. What do you see as the Obama record?
Well, I agree with that critique, and I think it's a dilemma. That is, I mean, the reason Obama isn't doing that, didn't go to Wisconsin, or weigh in on the side of the teachers in Chicago, is he wants to win Virginia and North Carolina and all these and Florida, etc., where there is a kind of toxic anti-union right to work kind of atmosphere. Right to work generates this sort of popular anti-unionism as well as, and so he wasn't going to weigh in on that, but I think that's very short-sighted, because the backbone of the Democratic Party, the backbone of liberalism, is in fact the union movement, and I think Obama should expend some of his political capital in defending public sector unionism in Wisconsin or the teachers in Chicago. He should weigh in. He hasn't done that. He gives a speech on Labor Day, but when it comes to a real conflict, I think the callers are rightly critical of him.
So briefly, though, isn't there an inherent conflict of interest in public sector collective bargaining? They make among the biggest campaign donations to state and local politicians and do among the most lobbying. And so the politicians who they own are negotiating across the table from them on behalf of the taxpayers. Imagine if the union leadership was being paid in part by management. Wouldn't that be a conflict of interest?
Well, tell that to Rahm Emanuel. He didn't seem to be in cahoots with the Chicago teachers. No, that's a kind of a logical argument you presented. But in reality, it isn't the case. Public officials fight public sector unions tooth and nail all the time, and in fact they seem to be winning these days. I'm not talking about Republican public officials, I'm talking about Democratic as well. People who work at the workplace, you know, they need representation in one way or another, and in the northern and western states, you know, they get it in the public sector. In the south it doesn't exist, and you have the same kind of fiscal crises and problems in southern states as well.
And our next guest, I know we'll have a different view of public unions, but Nelson Lichtenstein is professor of history at UC Santa Barbara and editor most recently of The Right and American Labor, Politics, Ideology, and Imagination. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. 30 Issues in 30 Days. Issue 5, Unions and Right to Work, continues after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. See all 30 at WNYC.org/issues. We posted questions for all 30, by the way, so you can get the conversations going in advance of those topics, radio days. And you've got to see our data graphic for today's issue 5, which is unions versus right to work. This is a graphic of work stoppages of 1,000 workers or more by the year that the job action started. And you will see an astonishing curve of the stoppage of work stoppages in the United States from the 1940s until now at WNYC.org/issues. Click on issue 5. Now we're going to, before we talk to our next guest, who's in a politically different place than our last guest, we'll take some of your phone calls. And the question is, what should government's role be in facilitating unions or hampering unions, or anything else you want to say on this? 212-433-WNYC. Alan in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Brian. Once again, a wonderful program. I think Obama's doing the best he can with the cards he's being dealt. But having said that, I think it was incredibly hypocritical for Bill Clinton to be given such prominence at the convention, and no mention being made of the fact that he was the one who decided, before there were environmental and human rights standards applied to China, to give them most favored nation status, which basically allowed them to have millions of American jobs shipped over there. And if you apply the Republican Supreme Court test of speech equals money, if you have Chinese officials denying workers their right to free speech to organize and petition the government, then that denied right represents a fantastic amount of dollar subsidy to Chinese workers with which American workers are forced to compete.
Alan, I appreciate it. I'm going to leave it there. Tomorrow's issue, by the way, is going to be free trade, and we'll certainly talk about the history of the Democrats and Clinton embracing that in his time and the ramifications of that. Eric in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Yes, hi, Brian. I just want to thank you for a great program.
Thank you.
I think the professor raises an important point about the equality of power issue raised by the Wagner Act. But I think it's more practical to speak about it at the worker level. And this is about a living wage. And that's what this union, non-union debate is about. And I want to say the prevailing wage is a living wage. But now many municipal contracts are closing down the field to smaller contractors. They're requiring things like apprenticeship programs, for instance, that only large union shops can truly implement. So you really don't have a level playing field.
Eric, thank you. Andy in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andy.
Good morning. I just want you, all you folks out there, to know that I'm in the United States Postal Service. You're one of the public safety unions.
Mm-hmm.
The union is here just to protect bad employees, and anyone who is a good employee, they don't get represented. Secondly, they're pricing us out of the market. Plus, they tell us that they lower the productivity levels, and then we don't have to do anything. It's just punch in, get a check. No wonder the Postal Service is losing billions of dollars every year through non-productivity. Now, my father was a union man. He was a butcher. And he told me that when he lost a job in 69, when I was just a baby, he said the union priced him out of the market. It's always more, more, more. And he struggled to get union jobs until he worked in non-union shops. He had to work two jobs.
How did you wind up so skeptical of a union if you're in one and protected by it?
Well, because, first of all, protection, I was in management for just 4 months as an acting supervisor. And because I made everyone work and raise our productivity just by 6%, because I'm white and they're not, they labeled me a racist and made me sit down. They filed grievances against me, and they, instead of going the usual route, they went to the plant manager, said this guy's a racist because he's making everyone work and enforcing the rules equally. We can't have this.
Right. So,
we have to have favored status for this one and favored status for that one,
so
based on
can't,
gender and ethnicity.
Right, okay. So I don't want to get into, you know, and I have no idea what happened in your case and whether race played a part, but do you think the unions should have no role, or should they be improved so they can do good and not be excessive?
The public sector unions are way too powerful, and they mismanage the money. Look at what Richard Trunka did last year for the Occupy Wall Street. He gave our money, $13 million, to these slackers who committed all these crimes. He gave them food, medicine, tents, and all kinds of other equipment so that they could live on our streets.
Andy, I'm going to leave it there, and I appreciate your call very much. Mario in Manhattan, you're on the air next. Hi, Mario.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Good show. But I think to have a discussion about whether Obama or Romney are who's more pro-union is kind of like splitting hairs. I mean, our president has surrounded himself with the top of the top of the promoters of a neoliberal agenda, an anti-labor agenda. A president who put in Arne Duncan, the architect of some of the most anti-union education policies in the country. You know, a president who has promoted a trade agenda that's eroded and destroyed the American industrial base and continues to erode private sector unions.
So even when you look down the different tick-off items on their websites and you see Romney says explicitly protect the right of businesses to move out of state if their state enables a strike, if their state law, Romney wants to shut down the NLRB, Romney wants to end card check the way it exists or not allow it. Do those all add up to nothing to you?
I mean, the Obama position is very much like a Band-Aid on a huge wound. So Obama has not actually promoted or fought for the major piece of organizing legislation which unions have been calling for, which is which is national card check.
Mario,
thank
you very much. I get you. And we'll get one more voice on here and then bring in our next guest. And that voice is Deborah in Newark. Deborah, thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks very much. I want to frame your question with a historical perspective. With the near demise of private sector unionization, by default, public sector positions remain the largest union groups in the country, and the single largest union group is the teachers' union. Over the past 30 years, we've seen the demonization of teachers. At the same time, we've seen the privatization of American education through voucher systems and charter schools and the budgetary starving of the beast of American education so that teachers are blamed for the diseducation of our children. And when the public teachers' unions are finally broken, we will see with it the historical demise of the organized American labor union movement as we've known it.
Deborah, thank you very much. And I think that leads us perfectly into our next guest on 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 5, Unions versus Right to Work. He is Daniel DeSalvo, political science professor at the City University of New York and a senior fellow at the Conservative Manhattan Institute think tank at their Center for State and Local Leadership. Professor DeSalvo, thank you very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Brian.
And I've read that you go so far differently from Deborah and Newark as to suggest that perhaps public sector labor unions should not even exist. Is that right?
Well, I don't think I've ever quite put it that starkly in anything I've ever written, but I have argued in favor of reform in public sector labor relations to, in some sense, recalibrate the balance between government managers and taxpayers on one side and labor organizations on the other.
So, for example?
So, for example, I think that states should and localities, cities, should experiment with reforms in their public sector labor relations, whether that's along the lines of what Scott Walker has tried to do in Wisconsin, what Rahm Emanuel is trying to do in Chicago, what Chris Christie or Governor Cuomo have done here in New York and New Jersey.
Shouldn't the right to organize be equally available to all workers in our democracy?
I agree that it should, and I believe that it will remain so since it's a First Amendment right. I don't think the right to organize has really been in question. Now, whether the right to collectively bargain and what the subjects of collective bargaining should be have obviously been the subject of contentious debate, as well as right-to-work laws or agency shops, have also, which, of course, in some ways give enormous advantages to unions in organizing. Those have been subjects of debate, but I don't think the right to organize by itself is in question.
I got that statement of how far you think it may be necessary to go from a Star Ledger article, an interview with you in which it characterized you as suggesting that it may become necessary to eliminate public sector unions, but you don't actually go that far.
Well, I don't think that that's really going to be a reality, I would say, at the moment, given the trouble that Governor Walker's had enacting his reforms in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is probably likely to remain an outlier on the national stage, but it will serve, I think, as an interesting laboratory of democracy to see if the claims that Governor Walker made, that reducing the scope of collective bargaining and eliminating the agency shop, does lead to a better fiscal picture for the state.
What about private sector unions? That's most of what we talked about with our last guest. And you heard him argue, in effect, that the demise of private sector unions, down to now maybe 7% of the private sector workforce being represented, is one of the causes of redistribution of wealth in this country into fewer hands.
I'd say there's probably something to that, that certainly there's a correlation of a sort between the declining power of unions and rising income inequality.
And Republicans talk about redistribution of wealth, as in Romney's 47% remarks, but hasn't the real distribution in this country in the last 30 years been from worker to owner, from middle class to the top two few percent, aided by the demise of private sector unions?
Well, certainly private sector unions have been under enormous strain from especially global competition and the decline of American manufacturing. As far as the trends in economic inequality, we can bore down into the statistical details, but much of this has really been a rising gap from the very top of the income scale that is increasingly gobbled up a larger share of income. But whether that's been a dramatic shift in power, that's, of course, a subject of debate.
Well, I guess that implies the question, what is this whole area of battle about? Is it who gets to keep more of the spoils of capitalism, if you will, the owners who invest their money or the laborers who do a lot of the work?
That's partly what this is about. I think when we're talking about private sector labor, in my view, even if the Obama administration had gotten completely behind check card, for example, I think that would have made maybe a modest uptick, marginal at best, in the percent of private sector workers that are unionized. But I just don't see the factors existing today in the American political economy that's going to lead to a dramatic revival of private sector unionism.
Well, let's go down some of these Romney versus Obama positions based on their websites for their campaigns and get your take compared to our last guest. On a federal right to work law, would that be a good thing? And if so, for whom? Romney seems to endorse that.
I guess Romney seems to endorse that. For who it would be good for, it would be good for states with strong where private sector unions are strong. It would clearly give managers and owners of businesses in those places much greater flexibility.
Do you understand the proposal? Now, I didn't see this one on Romney's website. I have to say I saw it on Obama's website where he said, watch out, Romney is for a federal right to work law. So I wonder if you're familiar with that proposal and whether that would, as a national federal law, make all states right to work states.
I must admit I haven't looked at detail in that proposal, if such details exist.
Reversing President Obama's executive orders is another thing on Romney's website on labor that he says tilt the playing field toward organized labor. Our last guest was actually not sure which executive orders he may have been referring to. Do you happen to know?
Like your last guest, Professor Lichtenstein, who I admire a great deal, I'm not sure either.
How about doing away with the National Labor Relations Board?
As a proposal from the Romney campaign?
Yeah. What would that mean, and would you be for it if you take positions on these things?
On these contentious disputes in the private sector, I don't take many positions. I could at least say that clearly there would have to be another mechanism in place to adjust or deal with disputes as they arise between owners and managers in the private sector.
I know you've looked at the New Jersey situation between Governor Christie and the unions there, teachers and others. Where do you think that fits in to the national debate over public sector unions?
Well, I think that in the wake of the Great Recession, the economy took a real hit and state and local governments saw their tax revenues decline. This new age of austerity has set up a conflict between governments and their employee unions. In New Jersey, I think it fits. I mean, in some ways, Chris Christie was out ahead of others in bringing this conflict to light, but he hasn't acted alone. He's acted with Democrats in his state in a bipartisan fashion.
To do what? What do you think has really changed on his watch?
Well, I think there's been two broad things that have happened. One is related to the most recently, which is related to the teachers, which is modifying the teacher tenure law to increase the time it takes to get tenure in the public schools. And make it easier for principals to fire poor performers. The second thrust is changes in the pension and health care scheme for public employees in New Jersey. Both legislative thrusts were strongly opposed by the state's public employee unions, led by the teachers' unions.
What does the term right to work mean to you? We heard it a lot in the Republican primary debates. This was one of the topics that kept coming up, and they were kind of trying to outright to work each other. I didn't hear it much at the Republican convention. Maybe it's going to come up in the Obama-Romney debates. What does the term right to work actually mean, and what do you think its significance is in 2012?
Well, right to work comes from allowing states in the wake of the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 to pass what were called right-to-work laws, which basically forbid agency shops. An agency shop is a requirement, a condition of employment such that you must pay called agency fees to the union insofar as it represents you in labor negotiations. So example, here in New York, I'm a CUNY professor. A condition of employment is that even if I don't officially join the union, I must pay agency fees, which are virtually identical to union dues. And then the state of New York collects those fees and then sends them on to the union. So the union doesn't actually do its own fundraising like another interest group would. So in the South, in the right-to-work states, agency fees are illegal. Unions can organize, but the state or government entity will not act as their fundraiser in that sense.
Before you go, I want to get your take on a bit of Obama rhetoric and a bit of Romney rhetoric. We're going to play a short 20-second or so clip from each. Here is Obama on Labor Day 2011 in Detroit.
And we're going to keep at it. Because having a voice on the job and a chance to organize and a chance to negotiate for a fair day's pay after a hard day's work, that is the right of every man and woman in America. Not just the CEO in the corner office, but also the janitor who cleans that office after the CEO goes home. Everybody's got the same right.
The janitor who cleans the office after the CEO goes home. Now, listen to Mitt Romney also refer to CEOs in a speech he gave to the Conservative Political Action Committee last year.
Because great schools start with great teachers, we'll insist on hiring teachers from the top third of college graduates, and we'll give better teachers better pay. School accountability, school choice, cyber schools will be priorities. And we'll put parents and teachers back in charge of education, not the fat cat CEOs of the teachers' unions.
I think that's the only time I've ever heard Mitt Romney referred to fat cat CEOs, and it was fat cat CEOs of the teachers' unions.
Yeah, it's striking, isn't it? I guess to respond to the both of the clips, you know, in Obama's case, that's a familiar kind of union-style rhetoric that collective bargaining is a fundamental right. I guess one might be slightly skeptical about that given the vast variation in the realization of that right across the nation. And, of course, what voice means when channeled through mandatory collective bargaining for workers is obviously something that can be the subject of dispute, and different places can do this in different ways. As for the Romney quote, I think Romney's playing into what's been an issue across the country for both Democrats and Republicans, which is teachers' unions are, I think, one of the most powerful players in the education politics of the country. And given both the fiscal situation and the performance of the schools, are a ripe target for attack.
Wen from Brooklyn on our website writes, "The elephant in the room is globalization. You can unionize in the private sector all you want, but if you price yourself out of the industry you work in, the industry will be forced to move or die. People are not going to pay extra for unionized good. Low price wins. It's a fact of life." So we will let that sit as a promo for tomorrow's segment in this 30 Issues in 30 Days series, when we talk about free trade as an issue between Obama and Romney. That concludes our segment on unions versus right to work. My guest has been Daniel DeSalvo, political science professor at CUNY and senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And again, listeners, you can see all 30 issues and start commenting in advance. Get those conversations going in advance of their radio days at WNYC.org/issues, and see the great data news graphic that we have showing the precipitous decline in strikes in the private sector in the United States from 1947 to the present. And coming up next, a call in to give advice for penny-pinching college students. We have a few minutes left for this at the end of the show. It's just a couple of weeks into the college year, and we figure that any college student in New York probably needs some help finding ways to save money on the day-to-day. We talked about the expensive tuition and room and board and fees yesterday, so how about living day-to-day? We're going to collect your tips right now on any way for a college student to save some money living in the New York area, 212-433-9692. The difference between an $8 sandwich and a $5 sandwich can change your diet entirely and change your life. Give us your tips for college students trying to survive on a budget in New York, 212-433-WNYC.